My guest today is Herb Bix. Herb is a Japan expert. There have been a lot of goings on in Japan since the last time Herb was on. I want to start off with a few comments of my own, but there's a new government there. There's a new prime minister. Japan changes its governments and its prime ministers about as often as some people change their socks or underwear. You would think after all the changes they would finally get it right. Well, since World War II, I'm not certain they ever got it right. They certainly don't have it right now. When I get connected to Herb, I'll let Herb explain because he knows the country very, very well. Let me just make a few comments to begin with, especially while we're waiting to get connected with Herb. Yesterday, James Petras was on. He wrote, I think, the best article on Hugo Chavez that I've read. It was very detailed. It was very incisive. It was a marvelous article. I've written a number of articles since Chavez died on March 5th. I honestly believe that Obama ordered him killed and succeeded. And that was the topic of one of my articles. I mentioned it in another one. I did an interview on Press TV. They astonished me. We discussed this issue. We discussed more than this issue, but we discussed this one. And afterwards, they told me it was their most watched video interview ever. I think they meant separate interviews, brief ones, as opposed to individual programs or other things like that. But I was absolutely stunned by that. I touched a nerve. And when we're talking about the Press TV, we're not just talking about people in Iran. We're talking about viewers and listeners. I consider myself a listener because I'm concerned more about the information than the videos. But people who want real information can get it from Press TV. And it's a worldwide English language broadcast. So we're talking about people all across the world who tune in on Press TV on every continent. And Press TV probably has more viewers outside of Iran than it does inside Iran. So that's very telling. A lot of people believe that there was some nefarious stuff that went on. I absolutely believe it. Since World War II, America has tried and either succeeded or failed to assassinate over 50 foreign leaders. Over 50. So that's getting pretty close to trying to kill one a year. They tried hundreds of times to kill Castro. Hundreds of times. I wrote about it years ago. Incredible. How he survived is really a modern, maybe not so modern, miracle, but very much a miracle. But he did. And one time he almost didn't. An assassin literally had him face to face in the crosshairs. He could have killed him, and he didn't do it. He chickened out. Why? Who knows? But he didn't do it. Second thoughts. I'd love to know what they were. Castro could have been dead years ago. Instead, he survived. He survived a very, very tough illness that took a very long time to come back from. He's alive and doing well at age 86. Chavez died at 58. He had so many good years left. Again, I say I wrote daily articles on him until a day or two ago. And today, because Jim Petras inspired me, I decided to do another one. It'll go out tomorrow. I call it Chavez late to rest. Venezuela has mourned for 10 days. Yesterday was a very, very tough day to go through. I have a friend in Caracas. He sent me photos, visuals of what went on in the city. A parade to transfer Chavez to either his final resting place or his temporary one before a final one is chosen. It was very dramatic. It was still photos. They were very dramatic to view. It was very hard to look at them. I could imagine the feelings of the Venezuelan people. Who knows how many turned out? I'll bet there were a million or more in Caracas. The streets were absolutely jam-packed, shoulder to shoulder, shoulder to shoulder. Shows the overwhelming support he had. Well, I believe that his legacy lives. Bolivarianism lives. Chavismo lives. There'll be another election, new president, on April 14th, just about a month, 2 weeks from tomorrow, four weeks from tomorrow. Chavez urged the Venezuelan people to elect Nicolas Maduro, his then vice president, his now acting president, in case he could not serve. I believe he has overwhelming support. I've only seen a couple of polls. I'd like to see more. There'll be more as we get closer to Election Day. I'm guessing he will get 60% or more majority. Chavez's largest majority was 63.7%, and I wrote an article about that after the election in 2006. I think we have Herb on now. Or do we? No.
Yeah, we do.
Oh, we do have Herb on now. Herb, bear with me just a moment. I'll finish this thought and then jump right to you.
Okay.
I wrote an article that I said Chavez's 2006 electoral victory topped all U.S. presidential victories in history. Well, I went back post 1820 because elections really weren't elections up to that time. They were more coronations than elections. But post 1820, Obama, Chavez's electoral majority exceeded the majorities of every elected U.S. president in history to this day. The closest one was Lyndon Johnson in 1964. I think Richard Nixon was second of all people in 1972, either 68 or 72. I forget the year, but it was dramatic, absolutely dramatic. He got just under 56% this last time. I think Maduro will get about 60% or more. There's no way the Venezuelan people are going to elect an oligarch crook, which is what Enrique Capriles is. He's a crook. He represents money power. He represents the dark past that Venezuelans want absolutely no part of. There's no way on God's earth they're going to elect that guy. No way at all. Anyway, April 14th, I'll sure write about it after it happens. I can't imagine I won't write about it leading up to it. If there's anything important to say, I'll write about it. We'll discuss it on this program. I'll keep you informed. Bolivarianism lives. Herb, let's jump across that big ocean and talk about Japan. I welcome you to the program. I seem to have your wrong number. Maybe you can update me after
the
program.
Yeah, I will. Here. I'll send you the update. I'm here in Cambridge, Mass. now.
Oh, you moved to Cambridge?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. Well, I spent a few years in Cambridge.
Okay. Well, Steve, since you're talking about elections, I'll talk about Japan. What is it, a 7,000-mile journey from Cambridge to Tokyo?
At least.
And so let's talk about the election, because we learn a lot from analyzing election results. And Japan, as you know, in December of last year, had a general election to its powerful House of Representatives, the lower house, and the more powerful one. And it was the first election since the Great East Asia Japan earthquake and the nuclear catastrophe at the Fukushima complex.
Could I get one comment in and let you continue? Japan matters because Japan is America's, dare I say, main ally in the Pacific region. The country has also been occupied since 1945. It's a strong country economically. It's a strong company militarily. So America depends on Japan hugely. It's a very, very vital ally for America and its imperial project. So what happened to Japan, Herb, matters a very, very great deal.
Yeah.
Let me let you continue.
Okay. Well, so we have this hawkish politician, Abe Shinzo, winning a solid victory and restoring to power the Liberal Democratic Party that had governed the country for half a century, restoring also the coalition partner of the Liberal Democrats, the new Kometo Party. So here we have a man who had 5 years earlier resigned after less than a year as prime minister because of scandals and incompetence. And during his five-year hiatus from power, he had been an advisor to a so-called research society, which was a faction of the LDP headed by this guy, Mori, Yoshido. And Abe held power in this extremist faction, and he'd deliver an occasional lecture, and all the while he watched for his chance to regain high office. And that came amidst the Japanese people's rush to recover from the nuclear disaster in the Northeast. So we have Abe returning to power when his party secured 294 out of votes, seats in the lower house, and the lower house has 480 seats, so that's 61% of the seats. And its coalition partner, the Kōmeitō, the new Kōmeitō party, won 31 seats. And then you had a minor party coming that was recently cobbled together by the former mayor of Tokyo, Ishihara Shintaro, and the longtime governor rather than mayor, and he worked with the mayor of Osaka, a guy by the name of Hashimoto Todo. So here we have Japan. It's in its fourth recession since the year 2000. And the big loser, the big winner, was the LDP, and the big loser was the Democratic Party of Prime Minister Noda Yoshihiko, who was dismissed having failed to deliver Japan from protracted economic stagnation. The Democratic Party lost both public and media support during the tenures of its three prime ministers, Hatoyama, Yukio Kanaoto, and Noda himself. Now, across the Pacific, in our country, the party had incurred Washington's displeasure over its failure to move forward with relocating the Marine base at Tema on Okinawa and establishing a new American military base at a place called Henoko. So, what did Noda's government do? Noda's government purchased the Senkaku Islets. You've heard about them. Maybe you've talked about them on your show.
Oh, indeed. I wrote a little bit about them.
Okay. Well, that ignited Chinese anger. And the LDP and other rivals were able to outmaneuver the Democrats under Noda by exaggerating the military threat from China and North Korea. So we can say that ultimately, I mean, these things happened, but ultimately the Democratic Party failed to overcome Japan's economic stagnation, and it failed to exercise effective leadership in the wake of the earthquake and the tsunami and the nuclear power meltdown. And both before and during the election, the Democratic Party had been unwilling to publicly expose the LDP's long record of misrule and corruption. So let's begin with Abe, because I think that this is very interesting, the issues that we can get into here.
It's his second time around as prime minister. Is that correct, Herb?
Yeah, it's his second time around. So we have the comeback kid, 59 years old. He was born to a high-ranking political family and groomed since childhood for a political career. His grandfather was the former prime minister, Kishi Nobusuke. So the genealogical tie is very important, because Abe idealized his grandfather and may have absorbed Kishi's negative attitude toward the Constitution, which, as you might remember, was drafted during his imprisonment as a Class A war criminal. Moreover,
I don't remember that.
Well, Kishi, and this is more interesting, Kishi shaped the political order into which Abe fitted. And he did so through his system of money politics. Everyone's heard about Japanese money politics. He did so also through his diplomacy of turning American ideological extremism to Japan's advantage. And he did so finally through his forced renewal of the security treaty with the U.S. in 1960 against the opposition of the most powerful grassroots political movement in all of Japanese history. So we keep these things in mind, and we have Abe forming a cabinet. His cabinet combines the mainstream and extreme right-wing currents of post-war conservatism. Mind you, two currents. His coalition cabinet is composed of bureaucrats and politicians who are committed to the full neoliberal economic agenda at home and an expanded liberal interventionism abroad. Well, you may ask, what form does the liberal interventionism abroad take? And here we go back to the breakthrough that was made in 2001 when, under Koizumi Junichiro, the prime minister, who instead of sending money, sent Japanese ships and military soldiers to help in the Bush's aggression against Iraq. Do you remember?
Oh, indeed.
How can we forget? So, in other words, liberal interventionism abroad for Japan takes the form of UN peacekeeping operations, takes the form of continued subservience to the Obama administration in its wars and humanitarian interventions, and it takes the form of an assault on the peace, on Japan's constitution, the peace constitution. Now, the one thing that the LDP planned for Japan's recovery and reconstruction in the years ahead, and mind you, it's still early days here, but the one thing that it doesn't, the LDP plan doesn't encompass, is reform of the political structure of Japan's modern development. That it leaves unchanged. Now, let's get more concrete and examine a few key individuals whom Abe vested with executive power. And that way, you can get a glimpse of where Japan may be headed. Do you want to say anything at this point?
Well, let me let you go on, Herb. You know this much, much better than I do. I occasionally touch on Japan, especially if I'm writing about what Obama is doing in that part of the world, especially the confrontation with China and Obama's Asia pivot. But I certainly don't know Japan the way you do.
All right. Well, I can't go through the whole cabinet lineup, but I want to pick out a few things, a few points. We have another failed ex-prime minister with little economic expertise. His name is Aso Tado, and he became Abe's finance minister. And Abe is also a neo-nationalist, and he's a dynast with genealogical ties that could put Abe to shame, because he's tied to leaders, also is tied to leaders of the Meiji Restoration, the pre-war court group through his grandfather, Count Makino, and the leaders of big business through his own ownership of the family business, the Aso Cement. Moreover, Aso's mother was the daughter of Yoshida Shigeru, the prime minister during the U.S. occupation, and the man who formulated the strategic doctrine of never getting ahead of the U.S. in foreign policy matters. So that's Abe's choice of finance minister. And he chose Amari Akira, an advocate of restarting nuclear reactors. Remember, Japan's 50 operable nuclear reactors were shut down following the March 2011 triple meltdown at Fukushima. But this man, Amadi Akita, is now the Minister for Economic Revitalization, and he intends to get them open, as does Abe, to restart them. And then there's this Katayama Shachi. Excuse me?
A terrible decision during the Fukushima debacle. I wrote plenty about that. I'm not certain how many. I bet I wrote a dozen times or more about it. And of course, the disaster is a disaster that goes way beyond Japan. And I got emails from people who have some expertise in just how bad things were or might have been. And they warned me, whenever it rains in Chicago, be sure either not to go out or be sure you have an umbrella, because irradiated rain will come down on you. Well, you know, when you step outside your front door, you're walking on radiation, but that radiation spread over a good part of the planet.
Yeah. Well, that's true. That's quite true. But let's look at the next person, because we want to build up a sense of where Japan is going. We have Katayama Satsuki, and this lady is noted for her passionate advocacy of reducing welfare, of reducing what she calls livelihood protection in Japan's increasingly geriatric society. And she's become a ministerial aide. Well, turn to the defense minister, Onodera Itsunori. He's a continuation of the Democratic Party's defense minister. The foreign ministry went to Kishida Fumio, a former minister of state for Okinawa and a specialist on territorial disputes. And if there's time, I'd like to suggest, as a Japanese sociologist did recently in a book, that, you know, the nuclear disaster has to be connected to Okinawa. And I'd like to suggest that that's a very keen insight, and I'll get to it in a moment. So we have Kishida, the foreign minister, who had served in Abe's first cabinet. He believes strongly in strengthening the Japan-U.S. military alliance, which endangers mainly the lives and property of people on Okinawa. Because they're the ones most often victimized by crimes committed by American military personnel or their family members. But this Kishida, the foreign minister, also believes very strongly in Japan's military self-strengthening. And like the other neo-nationalists in the cabinet, he decries a non-existent Tokyo trial view of history that has unfairly depicted Japan and allegedly diminished its pride as a nation. Okay, now the Justice Minister. It gets very interesting now. The Justice Minister, if I keep giving you Japanese names, the reader's eyes will glaze over, huh?
Oh, it is very, very hard to remember.
Sure.
Some of the ones who are better known.
Let me say the Justice Minister has worked quietly but steadily to rewrite the Constitution, retaining only parts that he regards as good. And it certainly has many good parts. Well, the Justice Minister was the one who established the committee to restore the LDP to power after it was repudiated by voters in 2009. And this man, the Justice Minister, is Abe's brain and an admirer of both Yoshida and Kishi, whose legacies he embodies. Well, it was the Justice Minister who was chosen on April 27th of last year to present to the world the LDP's draft of an autonomous constitution. The announcement was timed to coincide with the 60th anniversary of the coming into force of the San Francisco Peace Treaty, signed by Yoshida 3 years before the birth of the LDP. So So the San Francisco Peace Treaty was what restored Japanese independence at a cost that many conservatives found onerous. Well, just a week ago, well, today is what, the 16th?
Today is the 16th.
3 days ago, the Justice Minister held a press conference in which he stressed the need for authorizing three new essential articles. The first two aren't that interesting. They concern the national flag and anthem. Another article that he considers essential is one that makes explicit the right of self-defense. And the third is an article to establish the emergency situation. Now, at the press conference 3 days ago, the Justice Minister did not mention the draft Constitution's elevation of the Emperor's status from a symbol to a head of state. And since the symbol monarchy has become a symbol of Japan's subordination to the U.S., and the Abe cabinet is intent on turning the military into an offensive force destined someday for foreign battlefields, a term such as head of state, genshu, seems more appropriate to conservatives. Well, I'm going to go on, and if I had more time, I'd really go on and explain that when you look at the LDP Secretary General, who was Abe's chief rival, he must be included in the lineup of political elites, even though he's not a cabinet appointee, as far as I know. It is the Secretary General, the LDP Secretary General, who 6 days ago pointed out that Japan's constitution lacks a provision for the military to defend the country's independence because it was made when Japan wasn't an independent state. So the and he comes out and he says that the number one aim of the LDP is to make a constitution, and always has been the number one aim, to make a constitution that has essential articles. And absolutely essential is the Prime Minister's authority, is strengthening the Prime Minister's authority by giving him the power to declare the existence of an emergency situation. So already we got two key players calling, using the term emergency situation article.
We're going to take a short break that we do at the bottom of the hour. Hold your thought, and we'll pick up with it when we come back.
Okay.
On with Herb Bix. We're talking about a very important country in the Pacific region. Japan, of course, America's key ally, been that way for decades, since World War II, under military occupation then, under military occupation now, a vassal state. I don't know when Japan will ever grow up, Herb. Before I jump back to you...
Oh, I don't like you to use that, grow up. That's condescending.
Okay, I apologize. I do apologize.
Yeah. And it's not a vassal state. I mean, that's overdoing it, Steve.
Okay, I do apologize. It irks me that a country would give up some of its own sovereignty to value another nation's more. That's what I really mean herb, as opposed.
Well, you know, and I know that some people profit from it, and it was a calculation of there was more to be gained than lost by going this way. Because initially, Japan was compelled to do this.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
So, well, I was talking. Steve, should I continue?
Oh, yes, please do continue.
I was talking about the LDP Secretary General, and I'd like to point out that it was only, today is the 16th, it was only 6 days ago that he gave a lecture in Sendai City in Japan, pointing out that the very existence of the Japanese state can be at stake. The very existence of any state can be at stake in a huge emergency. So it's only natural that any country will temporarily restrict its people's rights in order to defend life and property. So he made that statement. And then he went on to call for inserting into the Constitution a clause that will give the Prime Minister the power to declare an emergency situation. Well, my answer there, thinking about it, was that this month, on the 11th of this month, was the second anniversary of the nuclear power generator meltdowns. And Japan, the Democratic Party Prime Minister Kan confronted this the emergency situation and muddled through based on a statute, but not on a constitutional, not on a constitutional article, because Japan didn't have an article in its constitution that provides for a system of emergency power. So, think about it. It would have been utterly useless in the face of an overwhelming crisis, even if Japan had a constitution with such power. An important lesson of Japan's defeat in World War II is that sacrificing civil and human rights to preserve the state sets a nation on the path to even greater catastrophes. And that's a lesson that the Liberal Democratic Party hasn't learned. And of course, the real foundation for the preservation of the existence of and defense of the Japanese state is not empowering the executive, giving the executive discretionary power to set aside the laws, whether that power is broadly or narrowly defined, but preservation of democratic principles rooted in the rule of law. And that imposes constraints on power. So, so I say that the insertion into Japan's constitution, I mean, assuming that they'll ever be able to do it, and I'll talk about the obstacles, but the insertion of such a provision by a single, to give prerogative power to a single individual at the top of the power structure, that's the hidden danger confronting Japan under this resumed LDP rule. And while few people may pay heed, this is just as important as the issue of revision of Article 9, the Peace Clause, or revision of another article defining the conditions for amending the Constitution. And I would go a step further, Steve, and I would say that the unbinding of executive power and giving the Prime Minister more discretion in declaring an emergency and setting aside the law is inevitably connected with a further growth of secrecy. And that means denying the Japanese people essential information to decide on matters essential to their lives at a time when their leaders are intent on strengthening military ties to the U.S., the superpower that has defined its national security so as to be permanently at war and constantly meddling in the political affairs of other nations.
Herb, if I could add one comment.
Yeah.
I knew that this transition was nothing to give cheers about, but
indeed,
I had no idea just how bad it is. You're explaining something that is a lot worse and a lot more worrisome than I ever realized. I think what you're explaining is very, very important.
Yeah, well, I do too, and that's why I've written this article, which should be out in a week, about it. Now, I didn't say anything about Abe's economic program. And let's talk, you know, Europe, the ruling elites all over Europe have embraced austerity. We're mired in, austerity talk. Well, let's look at Japan. The advent of this Abe cabinet immediately triggered a fall in the yen exchange rate and participation of a new round of trickle-down economics, a policy that the new prime minister dubbed Abenomics.
Now,
that's nice. So,
we have Obamanomics, so why not Abenomics?
Why not? Okay. So there's an economist, I think in Washington. I'm not sure. Richard Katz, and he argued very recently that a weak yen is going to help Japanese exporters, but it's not going to pull Japan out of recession, and it's not going to restore its economy to health because, as Katz said in International Economy was the journal, he said, and I quote him, because the yen rate is determined in global markets, not in the offices of the Bank of Japan. So, I think what's needed in Japan, as in the U.S., as in Europe, is the need to improve wages and living conditions. People need more money in their pockets. So, but instead, Abenomics, following in the footstep of the Democratic Party, offers hard-pressed Japanese households a rise in consumption taxes starting in 2001. Now, there's resistance to Abenomics from within the LDP itself, as well as from Japan's finance ministry and certain Japanese industries that need protection from foreign competitors. And Katz points out that more than half of the successful LDP candidates in the recent lower house election got the endorsement of the farm lobby by promising to oppose, endorsement from the farm lobby by promising to oppose participation in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, unquote.
I wrote about it. It's a big one.
Let's say a little about it. So a battle over the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which Abe is promoting, could not only alienate the LDP from its rural base, but also threaten support in the urban white-collar workforce, which is likely to suffer from neoliberal measures that strip middle-class, people of protections. So we have the current neoliberal program unfolding in Japan, and it differs. Abe's policy differs from his predecessors only in trying to combine cuts in social welfare, because Japan has pretty good social welfare program, with tried and true public spending on construction projects. Now, there are other signs that things aren't so well in Tokyo. I haven't talked about how Japan stands in OECD surveys of relative poverty, but it does come in the year 2010. It ranked fourth after Mexico, Turkey, and the U.S. in its rate of poverty.
Oh boy!
Relative to other countries. Now, Japan, don't get me wrong, is still a very wealthy country.
Indeed it is.
Because it's been at peace for so long, and because the Japanese people are very hardworking. Now, in addition to the steady rise of poverty in Japan, there's an interesting factoid that I'd like to mention that came out in the December election. The voter abstention rate was over 40%, the highest recorded in the post-war era. And so, too, were the record number of votes. More than 2 million voters invalidated their ballots by writing in their own choices of candidates.
So people are beginning to react. This is one thing that's been on my mind for so long, Herb. Why do Japanese people continue to elect the wrong people? And I guess it's the same reason why Americans and people in Western European countries elect the wrong people. I know there are dominant parties, and there really isn't much of a way of choice, but I would rather not vote than vote for somebody that I absolutely wanted no part of. So voting Republican or Democrat in America is literally throwing your vote away. You throw it away. You're voting for people who are against your own welfare, unless you're rich and so on and so forth. Then you absolutely want to support either party. But that's not the case for most people. And Japanese are the same way. So it's good to hear that maybe people are getting disgusted and either not voting or spoiling their ballots. Maybe that'll keep going.
Well, we'll see. Once Abe's cabinet was in place, he traveled to the United States. It was a journey to advance his economic agenda and pave the way for Japan's eventual participation in yet another American global project, because I think the Trans-Pacific Partnership is largely an American project.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's veiled in secrecy after 3 years of negotiation, and it's been criticized by union leaders and some journalists in this country as a, quote, global corporate takeover, a project to help the giant corporations of 11 Pacific Rim nations, maybe more, avoid regulations and remove protectionist barriers to their domestic markets. You know, it's NAFTA writ large over much of the globe.
I call it a trade deal from hell, Herb.
Yeah. So, anyway, so Abe goes to the White House at the end of last month, on the 22nd of February, and he tells President Obama that his government was examining Japan's exercise of a right of collective self-defense. And the conservative Obama offers him no encouragement for this plan, let alone a state dinner. And they say little in public about a special relationship, you know, as in the past. So, here's the story, and I want to end by making just a few more points, three more points. The U.S. is, nevertheless, it's moving forward to strengthen Japan's subordinate position in the military encirclement of China. You wouldn't disagree, would you, Steve?
Oh, I absolutely do agree. Okay. China and, of course, Russia in that region, because Russia not only comes borders with Poland in Europe, but it goes all the way to the Pacific Ocean. I mean, it's such a gigantic country. But yeah. America, for a long time, has been encircling China and Russia with military bases and the so-called missile defense that has absolutely nothing to do with defense. It's all about offense, and Russia and China
okay.
know it.
Well,
anyway.
Let's pick up what you just said about missiles. The Pentagon plans to install a second ground-based early warning radar system, ostensibly aimed at North Korea's missiles, but it has to be interpreted in China as part of Obama's Asian Pacific redeployment of forces directed at a rising China. So we're going to have this deployment of a new American ground base of a early warning radar system is going to be in Kyoto Prefecture. On the Sea of Japan coast. But why does Abe want this? Why is he doing this? Why is he encouraging this? Because he wants to be taken seriously, and he feels that only by building military power, because that's all that American leaders understand, only will that ever happen. U.S. policymakers, however, continue to take for granted Japan's complicity in their global war on terror, and they expect Tokyo's continued support of American military domination of the planet. So I think that a Japan that whips up alarmist scenarios about China's strategic ambitions, or a Japan that's embroiled in a volatile trade dispute, territorial dispute with China over uninhabitable Senkaku islets, such a Japan presents an unwelcome situation for American foreign policy. And why? Because of an armed confrontation, and I do not say it's likely, but it could happen. If an armed confrontation between China and Japan should arise because of a decision made autonomously in Tokyo or Peking, Obama would have to honor the Japan-U.S. military alliance and be drawn into it.
What is that alliance exactly, Herb? I'm not familiar with the details.
Well, it's an alliance that commits the United States to protect Japan by deploying its nuclear umbrella over the archipelago, and there's more to it, but I...
Is this part of the SOFA agreement?
Well, that is... The SOFA agreements can be called appendages, because wherever there are bases, then... And of course, the alliance provides for those bases. Then the Americans must have favored nation privileges, and that's what status of forces agreements give American servicemen and civilians.
They're very one-way agreements, as I understand, and I'm not certain they make them public, but they've been in operative in Japan for so long, and there are U.S. military bases all over Japan, especially on Okinawa.
Yeah. So I would just say here that no one should have been surprised. I wasn't surprised by the lukewarm reception Abe received from the so-called Washington consensus while he was there. But I don't think either Washington or Tokyo is really sure of how best to handle China's reshaping of geopolitics in the Asia-Pacific region. I just don't think they've figured it out. But the Senkakus is not the issue over which Obama wants to pick a fight with China, that's for sure.
I think you're right, Herb. And the islands, I think the issue there, I guess, is a little bit of national sovereignty and a whole lot of potential oil.
Well, yeah, the Americans have set aside the sovereignty issue, and I don't want to get into it. Of course, the waters around it, the fishing and the potential oil exploration. But I want to go and look at the larger strategic picture here.
Herb, let me just say this. We've got about 3, maybe 4 minutes left. Let me let you get all in all the important thoughts that you want to get in before the hour ends.
Okay. The first thought I want to convey to listeners is that the Abe cabinet wants to uphold Japan's ranking in the order of nations. His government thinks the only way to do this is to increase its military spending and for the Japanese people to work harder and make do with less after paying more taxes. Now, Japan, I did mention that one of the parties, the third party that won a surprising number of votes was the Restoration Party. And the Restorationists' support is largely on ideological grounds. This is a far right-wing party. All the election results that I've discussed this afternoon have to be interpreted in the light of the deepening commitment of Japan's power holders to neoliberal policy goals of market deregulation, privatization, and free trade. And these neoliberal policies have contributed directly to voter disaffection as well as growing poverty and insecurity. The last point I make is, could Japan be heading toward a new emergency power state? Well, everything depends on the July elections coming up for the House of Councilors, because if the LDP wins, it can anticipate a longer stay in power, which might be accompanied by a slow militarization of Japanese society. It would be slow, so we have to watch this. And I thank you for having me on your show, Steve. Maybe I've said too much.
Oh, no, you haven't said too much. And I feel at the end of every program, Herb, that even with a full hour, I have 30 minutes on Friday, I have a full hour on Saturdays and Sundays, yeah. And even with the full time block, commercial free with just a short break, you never have enough time to cover everything that needs to be discussed and explained and so on. And I wish I had a second hour. And if I did, I'd feel I wish I had a third hour, because these issues are involved and very important. You need to update them all the time. And to have somebody as expert as you on a subject that's very important and gets very little coverage in the mainstream, it's an important topic to discuss. I look forward to getting you back, Herb, so we can keep on this, because I'm very worried about what's going on in the Pacific Rim. And I don't know that a war will break out, but sometimes the unexpected happens, and I would consider it an absolute disaster if it happens, and that's a gross understatement.
Okay, Steve, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much, Herb. I'll just remind listeners that we are on every Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. We're on weekends, today and tomorrow, at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. I'll duck in one other comment. I wrote volumes on Chavez. I'll have a new article for tomorrow. Obama heads for Israel next week. He'll arrive as now scheduled on the 20th. I have an article going out on that tomorrow. It'll be on my blog site. It should get a fair number of posts. Take a look at it. If anything important happens, I don't expect too much. But if anything important does happen, I'll write about it. I'll mention it at least, maybe discuss it on this program. Do join us. Do make it a regular habit.